Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 256, and it's proudly brought to you by the ever-growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and would like to start supporting the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. Hey Jason, how are we doing?
I'm doing pretty well. We're enjoying a strangely warm late summer weather here, which is a little bit disconcerting, but you know what? I'm gonna live it up as long as I can before the cold descends on us here.
Yeah, I sat in the backyard yesterday and worked on a bunch of emails until I was tired of squinting at my laptop screen. But yeah, it's sunny and warm here. But looking at this is that fun time of year where you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, essentially.
Yeah.
So I think the cooler temps are coming, and I'm looking forward to some sweater weather. I really hope that what we get is that those like cool but not frozen. Mm-hmm. I would love that for a couple months.
Yeah.
I'm not used to it being essentially, you know, we're a week away from Canadian Thanksgiving now, and it visually it looks very much, but it's just not that cold yet. So we'll see what next weekend is like. You're headed to New York like in 24 hours.
Yeah,
and then I think I land in New York about 12 hours after you leave. So you're heading down for like one of those, you know, one night kind of press events.
Right. Yeah. I leave early tomorrow morning and I'll be back Thursday night. It's an event put on by Carl F. Bucherer, a brand that, you know, I haven't had much exposure to or spent much time with other than my trip to Ecuador back in August. And so they invited me out to New York for something that they're putting on. I think it's more of just kind of a general brand experience or kind of an introduction of some new watches and that sort of thing. So given that sort of burgeoning relationship with Bucherer, I thought I'd join for that and enjoy somewhat of a free day in New York on Thursday before I fly home in the evening. I deliberately requested a flight home later in the evening so that I could maybe make the most of my time out there. I just haven't been to New York since, but gosh, probably 2018 or 2019 maybe. And, you know, we'll see. I might just, I don't have any specific plans, maybe a museum or two, or maybe just walk around. I think the weather's supposed to be pretty decent. So not like the flooding of last week. So
insane. Yeah. Crazy stuff with the flooding. You know, my wife and I were considering the fact that, I guess, you know, had we still had the spot in Brooklyn, it would have been underwater.
Oh my gosh.
Like we had a garden level basement. So you're three steps below street level, right?
Wow. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that area we're in Crown Heights, would have been, you know, pretty wet, from that scenario. But yeah, I mean, that is going back to what you're talking about. Like that is kind of the superpower of a great city, like a New York. Is if the weather's bad, there's about 250 things you can do. They're all between $5 and $50.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather's nice, you can spend like nothing, whatever your lunch costs or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a ton of great places to. And if you haven't been to the city in that long, like I feel like you and I and Sarah had dinner in the city in 2019, I think.
Right.
So maybe that was the last time you were there. I think so. Fantastic Thai spot.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, there's just so much to do, just to kick around, and you could avoid so many of the like annoying spots pretty easily these days. So
I think I'm going to stay on the south end of Manhattan. That's where my hotel is, and I think this event. You know, I'm not that familiar with Manhattan, but I don't think I'll make it all the way up to Central Park or Midtown or anything like that. I think I'll just sort of, you know, kind of do a whatever's in the walking radius of my hotel and, you know, if the weather's nice, just to enjoy. I really like the South Seaport area. I remember kind of strolling through there and I think that's definitely within walking distance and I'll probably amble over there and grab some lunch and, you know, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those ones where it's kind of endless options. We go down Friday morning and we're recording something for Hodinkee that afternoon that I can't yet talk about. And then on the weekend, we have an event that'll either be Saturday or Sunday. I'm really hoping Saturday. It'll be a really fun event. I'm very much looking forward to it, but it's also Canadian Thanksgiving. So I would love the ability. Currently, we have like a later flight coming back on Sunday, and I'd love the ability to try and make that like the first flight, and then I could conceivably get home, jump in the Jeep, drive up to the cottage. A bunch of my family, like extended family, is going to do a dinner. Otherwise, I'll push all of my Thanksgiving stuff to Monday and see the family. So that should be good as well. But yes, just working on a few plans. It'll be a busy weekend. You know, there's a little bit of a sort of loosely private event going on that I've been asked to photograph for Hodinkee. So that should be super fun. We'll get to see some friends and do that kind of thing. But it would also be fine to stay home and have a normal Thanksgiving weekend with the fam, right? Like,
yeah,
kind of spoiled these days with fun stuff and that sort of thing. So
I feel like, yeah, for me, you know, it's been a couple of months and some pretty heavy duty travel, which I'm not as used to, or at least not since pre-pandemic days. And I'm after this New York trip, I don't have anything on the horizon planned, so I'm kind of looking forward to settling back in and finishing up a few things around here before, you know, before it gets too cold to do stuff outside. We still have kind of the garden to put to bed, and I've got to do a little bit of kind of pre-winter prep on the Land Rover, and you know, some concrete work on the front steps, and you know, all that sort of mundane household stuff. But I'm kind of looking forward to it, just as a bit of a change from packing a suitcase every other week.
Totally. In somewhat stark contrast to what to that line of dialogue, I get home Sunday from this thing. Monday we'll see the family and do a little Thanksgiving, and then Tuesday I head to Frankfurt. I'm with Leica for the week.
Your favorite airport.
Yeah, luckily no connection. So I'm actually very fine flying to Frankfurt if I get to be in Frankfurt.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never actually been let down where the flight to or from Frankfurt just doesn't happen at all. I just miss every connection.
Yeah.
At that airport. But this is an easy one. It's one of my favorite trips of the year. This year they actually have something that I get to be very excited about. I'm going with actual work in mind. Like last year I just went and hung out, like represented Hodinkee. We had the camera coming out with Leica. They needed, you know, kind of a warm body who loved cameras, and like my both hands in the air for that gig for sure.
Yeah.
And it was nice, and we got some fun stories. I got to hang out with some people. But this year there's a little bit more of a peg that I'm pretty excited about. But I go out Tuesday, I come back Friday. And I'm actually, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a relatively simple travel experience, to, you know, no connections, that sort of thing. You basically get out of the plane, jump in a car, and go up to Wetzlar. And This is my third or fourth time attending the Celebration of Photography. And I feel like this year I don't have to do all the same things I've done in previous years. I can kind of focus on a certain story or two that I'm working on, which I'm pretty excited about. But couldn't, you know, just flatly couldn't be a bigger fan of Leica and what they're up to. So I'm looking forward to see whatever's released this year in terms of cameras, and maybe see what they've got at the used shop. I could make a bad decision if I needed to. I'm not exactly short on lenses. Like I'm still running the Q. Everybody will get a lot of messages. People think that I'm running a Q2 or Q3. I'm still on a Q, the first one.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because I can't see how it would necessarily change my workflow or the quality of my work for Hodinkee. I've used a Q2 and a Q3, both incredible, but also both eye-wateringly matching incredibleness in terms of their price.
Yeah.
And I can't bring it upon myself, because the Q is such a lovely thing to shoot with to begin with. And I have multiple batteries, and I have a workflow, and I have kit that's kind of designed. And I mean, the newer stuff, aside from the batteries, would slot in nicely. But I can't just replace something for replacement's sake.
Yeah.
I'm just not there.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, I've got the 10, which I just simply adore, and I've got a handful of lenses for it. So I actually don't know, like, you know, I went last year and that ended up getting me the Type 20. I played around with Josh Rubin from Cool Hunting. He had his M10 monochrome with, or an M10D with the Type 20, which is the digital viewfinder, which makes it possible to do some macro stuff with the L Pro adapter that I've got. Anyways, this is turning into a photography episode, and I didn't mean it. I'm excited to be, if you couldn't tell, I'm excited to be back in Wetzlar with one of my favorite brands and so many great people. I have not experienced another brand like in cameras, watches, cars, any of it that is very similar to Leica.
Yeah.
In that they're a fairly large company with multiple production facilities and has their finger in multiple different pies, but they operate very much like a very small company. And I just think they've been making some great products the last few years, certainly as long as I've been included in this sort of press cycle for the Celebration of Photography. And I've met some absolutely incredible photographers and even some people I've since collaborated with here in the city. So hopefully get to continue all of that.
Leica is one of those brands, or you know, photography in general is such a complementary hobby, and in your case, it's definitely part of your work. But to mm-hmm. watches, and I think, you know, whereas, you know, people often talk about the overlap between cars and watches, I think photography and watches, there's definitely a strong connection. And then you put Leica in the mix with kind of the history and the craftsmanship and kind of the more of the kind of the luxury feel to their products, and I think it's just a nice sort of adjacent thing to appreciate that you can do along with a watch. It's a very portable device. It's very well mm-hmm. made. There's you know, history and kind of prestige involved, and yeah, it's fun that you get to do that every year. As part of Hodinkee, which is unusual. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's nice that, you know, the two brands have a nice connection together, both in the fact that they know that I'm using their gear to do basically the core tenet of the work, to make stories.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you know, a commercial relationship with the Hodinkee shop carrying the product and the Hodinkee LE team having done two limited edition cameras and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a good one. It'll be a lot of fun. Aside from that, man, I've just been kind of tinkering in the office. You know, finally got to hang up some art, and I put the IKEA pegboards back up, and then I was kind of flip-flopping on, you know, this is a little bit of a teaser for folks that are listening. At some point in the future, we're going to try video. It'll be a Zoom recording. It'll go to YouTube, but you'll be able to see us sit there and chit-chat about stuff. And if we talk about something, theoretically, we could either show it on the camera or embed it into the video. I'm not sure how much video editing work I'm actually willing to do. The schedule currently makes it difficult just to get the core show live every Thursday. But this is a little bit of a goal of ours, and I've taken it upon myself to just start buying gear to try it, which, of course, step. Is a fun side. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we've got a Wild webcam, the Insta360 Link, and have been messing around with that and really enjoying it. And then now I've been working my way into lighting, so I found the Elgato system, and now I've got I'm working on like building out macros and stuff into a Stream Deck and that kind of thing. So that's kind of been like when I'm not, you know, writing about watches or replying to emails or whatever, what I've been kind of thinking about is putting together a setup where, you know, whether it be for possible future Hodinkee podcasts or certainly for TGN, that we could, you know, click a few buttons and have a video that we could drop on YouTube for folks who would prefer to take in the media that way. It'd be the same yeah. thing as the audio, maybe with a few different edit points. I can't imagine editing the video as aggressively as I do the audio, but we'll see. But this all means there's a few things that before I commit to this, mm-hmm. in terms of any delivery, there's a few things I have to learn. Like, I haven't edited video since, when did I quit? My last day job was in video. So 2018, mm-hmm. I haven't really edited yeah. any video. So, I mean, like, we're talking about very basic, like take the video from Zoom and put a title card at the top and trim out stuff where you or I forget what we're talking about or lose track of a topic right. or whatever and make it look coherent. But other than that, like, pretty straightforward stuff.
Yeah.
So we'll see. A little bit of a teaser right now, but I've got a stack of gear in that I'm messing around with, and it keeps just screwing with the audio settings. And when we first started this episode, I was in slow motion, and then I sounded a little bit like a chipmunk, and theoretically I'm now back and lined up. So
yep, and I'll have to up my clothing and hair game, I guess, or else cycle through some caps. I certainly have no shortage of caps. And you know, you've been
Well, the makeup budget's going to be out of control for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And you've shown me some photos of your office setup, and it's inspired me to, you know, before we, you know, put our offices on full display, maybe work on mine a little bit. I think I might have to go for a new desk at some point. I've got this very big L-shaped desk that just doesn't lend itself to kind of nimbly moving it around the office to rearrange. And so I might have to make a move in that direction, but we'll see. Yeah. All TBD.
Yeah, definitely. I'm loving my standing desk. I did 6 hours of standing yesterday. Wow. Getting that back up, which feels kind of nice. But yeah. I've got lots of recommendations if you want desks or otherwise. We might have to make like a desk channel in workspace channel in the Slack, which I think could be fun because I spend too much time on the Reddit one, which is called Battle Stations.
Oh yeah.
It's like people's home office and or home workspaces and where they play video games and that kind of stuff. But we can get you some like brightly colored lights and stuff to for your background yeah. and get you all sorted out.
Right.
Well, look, now that we're, you know, the better part of 15 minutes in and barely mentioned a watch, what have you got on your wrist?
Well, it's exciting. As some people may have noticed via Slack or my Instagram stories, I am wearing a Pelagos FXD, the black dial version, the one that we saw at the launch event in Florida a few weeks ago. I now have one on my wrist, and it's my own, and it's not going anywhere fast. I think this is going to be one of those watches, and I know, you know, I say this often when I'm in honeymoon phase with a new watch, but I'm pretty certain it's going to be a keeper, but I think it's going to be one of those watches that gets a lot of wear. I mean, you know, you've experienced that with your Pelagos 39. It's just, yep. It's a hard watch to take off. And, this one just ticks so many boxes for me. And I kind of knew it right when we saw it, in Florida. And, you know, now that I've got it on my wrist and have played around with some strap options, it's pretty amazing. So I couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a bunch about it on a recent episode. If you didn't listen to the episode about the FXD launch in Florida, definitely go back and take a peek at that one. I, as a obviously a huge Pelagos nerd, and also someone who struggled with which one to buy for a long time, and every time a new one comes out, I think, well, maybe that's the one that I actually should have gotten. You know, it's like yeah. It's a little bit of a Pelagos sickness, if you will.
Yeah,
I'm just happy to have you as on the team. You know, here in the ward of the Pelagos insane. I'm a huge fan of the FXD. Definitely in my top five for Tudor right now. I think that the black one really kind of hits it. Something about that bezel just really speaks to me.
Yeah, and I think the sort of fixed the fixed nature of the strap attachment is something that some people find limiting. I find it really charming and quirky enough to kind of satisfy or kind of scratch an itch for me, because that's something I seek often with watches. I like something that has a little bit something strange or quirky, and I think sure. This. It sort of deliberately dresses this one down. It doesn't make any concessions or you know, pretend to be something that you'd even pretend to dress up with. And the matte finish and just sort of the very, you know, toolish nature of it, I think, is kind of right up my alley. In the same way that you know, a CWC does for me, or kind of any other watch that I'd like to kind of just throw on a NATO strap, like a Skirfa or something like that. So. Yeah, couldn't be happier. And you know, our wrist checks, as I kind of hinted, I think on the Slack channel, are going to be fairly boring, at least from my end, for the foreseeable future. I just can't see myself wearing much else for a while.
Yeah, I think I did like about 15 wrist checks in a row with the Pelagos 39, and I'll get back to it. I've actually been making like a concerted effort to not wear it, to wear something else.
Yeah,
because it just became like, it just steamrolled everything else I own.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is no matter what I choose, with the possible exception of CWC, which I have worn quite a bit recently, mm-hmm. I'm still leaning real hard on titanium.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wearing the Apple Watch Ultra a bunch. They released a new version of the software, which includes a new face, like a new dial.
Yeah.
And it's one I actually really like. And I've been wearing that a ton just to kind of, you know, keep an eye on fitness and all these sorts of things. And it's just a very handy, simple, easy to wear sort of smartwatch. But other than that, like wearing the Pelagos a lot, wearing the Skirfa a lot, like and that's what I have on today, my MS-22. Obviously the MS-23, which has the high accuracy quartz and a little bit of a different design, came and went in seconds.
Yeah.
On their website. You know, there were several folks on the TGN Slack that you know, made a concerted effort. Some got, some didn't. I bought this MS-22 secondhand. I just love it. I mean, like, the weirdly, it should be the watch that the Pelagos makes entirely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was going to the cottage for the weekend, I just grabbed it because I didn't have to set it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I finished my work day, took my Apple Watch off because that's kind of how I treat it, like a tool for work.
Mm-hmm.
Or for a given activity, rowing or biking or whatever, hiking, whatever you may be doing. But I don't know what it is about the Apple Watch, and maybe this is how I think of the watch. This is the most like concerted or concentrated way of how I think about the watch, is like, I don't see it as a watch.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It like takes up a watch space on my wrist, but I am, when I wear it, I'm thinking about what I'll switch to when maybe the workday's over. And I've been switching to the MS-22 for the whole week and, just loving it. I mean, great bezel, super legible, great loom. I've got it on a NATO, a new NATO actually, which I'll talk about at the end of the show. But it's been great, and still really just adore what Paul's up to. I also think it's interesting, like I had it on and I was on a couple of Zoom calls with a variety, you know, of Hodinkee employees, not on the editorial side, but on other parts of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And one or two folks were like, hey, is that a Skirfa? I've heard about them. And I'm like, oh, we're getting somewhere. This is
neat.
Yeah. Paul's expanding. So yeah, a good colleague on our marketing team, Adam, was like, hey, is that a Skirfa? I said, yeah. He goes, oh, which one? I goes, oh, it's the MS from last year. He's like, oh, I tried to get the new one and it just disappeared. And he's like, that's pretty cool for them. And I was like, yeah, no, it's been a cool run to watch them go and create new watches and to find kind of a zone of just offering this incredible kind of straightforward value statement that's like very easy to understand, even if you know very little about watches, but somehow is still super appealing if you know a ton.
Mm-hmm.
That you got to be a mark of a decent product and a, you know, well priced within the market.
Yeah, I think, you know, somebody mentioned on Slack that you know, pretty soon TGN is going to stand for Tudor Grey NATO instead of the Grey NATO, and I think we could make the T into titanium. I mean, you know, given that
sure, yeah.
You know, it's odds are one of us is going to be wearing a Skirfa, and odds are one of us is going to be wearing a Pelagos at any given time. So, yeah, two good picks. Yeah, we've got the kind of the high low titanium diver thing going on today.
Yeah, it's the titanium thing's really hard to dismiss.
Yeah,
I can understand why the people don't love it for their scratch resistance, but I haven't found either the Skirfa or the Pelagos to be especially scratch prone.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely scratch it; it's still titanium, but I haven't found it to be like covered in swirls and lose its finish very quickly. They both are really sharp.
Yeah,
and then just the weight, just easy to wear. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, as an aside, you know, you mentioned kind of putting the Apple Watch on for specific activities, and that's how I always was with my Garmin's. And since I got this, it's been a little less than a week. So that's not a really long time, but I've been wearing it for everything to the point where I don't take it off to even put the Garmin on to go for a bike ride, which I always used to do. But I think with this, you know, hook and loop or, you know, Velcro strap combined with the titanium and kind of the low profile of the watch itself, it really lends itself to just, you know, any sort of activity. And I've never really been averse to biking with a watch, but I think kind of the heaviness of other watches has caused me to kind of take it off and another reason why I reach for a Garmin. But this one's kind of a do everything. So,
well, congrats on that. And I'm sure I speak for a lot of the audience. It's about time. We've been talking about Pelagos. So I thought for sure it was going to be the Alinghi Chrono.
Going
to be the one that got you. And I love that you went with something that's like way more directly down your zone.
Yeah.
Very much more straightforward without the Red Bull branding and the coloring and the rest of it. I'd still super interested in seeing one of the, preferably the chronograph in person. And like, I don't know if you know, You're Terrific.
Oh, yeah.
On Instagram and YouTube. Evan, he picked one up. So I'm pretty excited to catch up on his video and coverage and that sort of thing, as I think he's a very reasonable guy in that space, and does a beautiful job with the videos. So yeah, I think it's a cool time to be into these sorts of watches, I guess. Maybe this is all of us just kind of, or maybe this is you and I just kind of stepping out from, you know, the better part of what, 7-8 years of vintage inspired stuff to just go like, I would say a little bit on the needlessly high-end side of the equation. The Skirfa and the CWC kind of prove that, but that definitely makes it fun. And when you work in the whole industry, it's easier to kind of, you know, talk yourself into those sorts of things.
Right.
But I'm happy for you. It's a great watch.
All right. Well, we have a very watch intensive episode here today, and I think it's going to be a really fun one.
Yeah. So we didn't really have like a specific watch we wanted to talk about. There wasn't like some new thing. We're between trips. So what we opted to do was to set up a sort of a challenge episode, another one of our challenge episodes. In this case, it's a one watch collection, but you have three price points. So you basically have to pick a one watch for under $1,000, a one watch option for under $5,000, and a one watch option for under $10,000. And there's no world in which we're owning all three of these. The idea is that it's a one watch at three different budgets, not essentially three watches for $16,000, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
We definitely have those in the audience who wouldn't spend more than $1,000, and we have some who would spend more than $10,000. But I think this kind of sits in the medium zone. And the funny thing is with a $5,000 limit, not only can... Oh, and the other kind of stipulation I made is that secondhand pricing is okay as long as you can find an active sale, but neither Jason nor I are allowed to pick a watch that we have owned or currently own. So we can't. I can't just say like, oh, for $5,000, I'll have my S302 because it's $500 too little for my P39.
Yeah.
Right. So this way, we had to think outside of our own little boxes, and we have three picks, three watches. All of them theoretically should represent what we want from one watch at a given price point. That feel like that covers it?
I think so. You know, but before we dive into our picks, did you have any specific criteria? I mean, given, so my understanding of this was that
what's our thinking?
Yeah, like this would be one watch that you're not going to own anything else. I mean, it's not just like you're going to buy your next watch. This is like the watch that makes up your collection. And I think that says a lot, or that will inform a lot of our criteria and our decision making when you don't have the option to have a beater and a dress watch and a vintage watch and whatever. I mean, this is it. This is what you get. So how did you approach this?
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing is my brain immediately started saying like, oh, I spent $1,000 on this watch, so this watch complements that one. I had to keep saying like, no,
mm-hmm.
These are three separate realities, three timelines, one with $1,000, one with five, one with 10.
Yeah.
And there's no overlap. So you needed three do-it-alls, essentially, three watches that could cover the gamut. And look, I live in a world where I probably don't need a dress watch.
Mm-hmm.
I could either go theoretically without a watch or wear one of the, wear the one watch that I've suggested here, depending on just how formal it is. But it's been several years since I did black tie. And I now ask before I agree to events.
Yeah.
If it's black tie. So I think I could, in my normal day to day, let's call it 350 days a year minimum, I picked watches that I could wear every single day, watches that I've always been either a little bit comfortable with, like from like I know enough about it, or ones I've always been curious about.
Mm-hmm.
And was your thinking any different? Or like I just tried to pick something that I thought I could wear, like I said, 350 days a year.
Yeah.
As you know, your everyday in and out does what I would need it to do in sort of a multi-role capacity.
Yeah, for me it immediately eliminated vintage because, you know, if I'm wearing something every day, I want good water resistance, good lume, both of which are questionable with vintage watches. Certainly you can bring them up to snuff, but there's just something inherently more fragile and less utilitarian about a vintage piece. So that eliminated vintage. Versatility, as you mentioned, you know, I don't really need a dress watch, so that opens up a lot of options. But the other thing that I thought about, and this particularly applies to the sub-$1,000 category, is, and I hate to say this because I do love micro brands. You know, we talk about Scirfo, we talk about, you know, Laurier a lot, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I was going to not go the micro brand route, even though there are a lot of good options sub-$1,000 and a lot of bang for buck. But if this is it, if this is the one watch, I wanted some assurance of reliability and long-term serviceability. And also, you know, I'll admit to a certain, I don't want to call it snobbiness, but a certain romance that I have for certain brands and kind of the idea of having a kind of a known brand on wrist. Especially if it's committed by one piece. And I think that really only applies to the sub-$1,000 level. I mean, you can get micro brands that are more expensive, but that was kind of my thinking.
Well, yeah, just because and I think the other trick here is that we aren't allowed to buy things that we've already owned.
Yeah, made it tricky.
So it might be something that we had in for review, sure, but like I couldn't just say I want my 16570 for the $10,000 choice, or
I want
my P39, which wouldn't even fit for the $5,000. But I do think what we should do is say, you know, we'll get to our picks. We'll start at 1,000. We'll get to our picks each. And then once we both set our picks, we should consider some of the alternatives
mm-hmm.
that were kind of on the table.
Yeah.
I think that could probably lead to the most interesting discussion. So if you like, the ball is all yours if you want to tell me how you would spend $1,000 on a one watch.
You know, the ultimate sort of one watch in this price range, in terms of kind of durability and versatility, is I couldn't get away from Seiko. I mean, as much as I would love to find kind of a Swiss-made, you know, watch from one of my favorite brands, I really had a hard time finding even anything pre-owned kind of in this price category that I really wanted. And so where I landed on this one was a pre-owned Seiko SPB 237. This is the, I think it was a limited edition, kind of the quote unquote Captain Willard edition with, it has that bit of a stippled sort of textured dial, and it came on kind of a neat looking brownish sort of olive drab woven nylon strap. And I found one on the Reddit marketplace for $850. And I think I've seen a few others kind of around that price, a little bit below $1,000. You know, you've had ample experience with the SPB line. I've had, you know, Turtles, and I've got a vintage Willard currently, that I love. I've always loved the look of this watch. I think, you know, the one hit that Seiko gets is, it's questionable accuracy. And I think that's never troubled me. It doesn't really bother me, especially at this price point. I don't mind maybe once a week taking it off and resetting it, you know, matching it to a time signal or my computer clock or something like that. So that isn't even really a factor for me. And I think the versatility of this kind of Willard formula, where I could put it on leather if I want, I could wear it on a Bund strap, I can wear it all day long on a NATO. You know, I don't really have a desire for a bracelet on a watch like this. So, $850 pre-owned. That's the way I'm going to go for the sub-$1,000 category, a Seiko Willard. And that kind of goes back to my roots. I mean, Seiko was my first foray into watches way back when I was a teenager, and I've had plenty since then. And I just feel like it's kind of coming home. It would feel right on the wrist as a watch that I would wear every day.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that idea. Solid watch. Great choice. I definitely had several Seikos pop up in my planning for the $1,000 price point, including like a 143.
Yeah.
I really wanted to focus for my choice. I was really, really focused on like how much watch can I get for $1,000 in terms of something I could do my every single day with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's some notable ones that we can't buy, which we can get to in a minute because we've already owned them or currently own them.
Yeah. That was tough.
So, you know, I've owned a lot of stuff under $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the watches I've owned are under this price point. I would, if there's a realm in which I'm an expert when it comes to watches, it would be sub-$1,000 watches. And the one that blew me away the most recently for being zero fuss, it's high accuracy quartz, has good water resistance, has excellent lume, it's super legible, it's very stealthy, is the Marathon Steel Navigator.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
12-hour bezel, so I can travel with this watch. It could absolutely be a one watch. It would work just fine as a backup to a dive computer, so I could dive with it. I would not have to take it off.
Yeah.
It does a NATO nicely. I think you could warm it up with a two-stitch vintage-style strap if you wanted to. You could put it on a mesh if you wanted to. You could do a lot with this watch. Keeps incredible time. Has a date. I like the tritium lume for a single watch option. The kind of watch you just never bother taking off.
Yeah.
And it's 960 CAD. So that's like $750.
Wow.
So I've got money left over for all the NATOs I could possibly want. I can make this watch feel like a different watch 3-4 times a week if I want between other straps, right? And I just like, I love the 12-hour bezel. I didn't quite have enough money for something like a Benris.
Mm-hmm.
To get the look, and also, like, you know, there's the CIA background to the Benris design, and the Marathon one kind of speaks to me as a Canadian. You know, I like these watches. I love that they now have the high accuracy quartz, and I was just very, very impressed by this watch when it came out. And it's a pretty under the radar sort of watch, so I don't think it got like an incredible amount of buzz outside of a certain group of people.
Yeah,
but I think it deserves more buzz than it got, and this is very seriously one of my favorite watches under $1,000. And when if we want to get to the other side of this coin, where we talk about some of the alternatives, like couldn't have an Aqualand, couldn't have a Halios, couldn't have a Scirfa.
Yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned a few brands that I was gnashing my teeth, thinking, if only we could pick ones that we've had or currently own, because I mean, I'd go CWC all day long, and I think I would just, you know, seek out a pre-owned quartz diver, Royal Navy diver. I mean, they do pop up with some regularity, below $1,000, you know, between 800 and 1,000, but can't do it. Yeah. You mentioned Halios and Scirfa, same thing there. The Marathon's a great choice. And especially if you can get one new, I think, you know, that's such a bonus. If in this challenge, if you can find, especially in this category, if you can find something new, you know, hats off for that. I kind of had two choices one as a backup for each of these categories. And I think this my second choice was, I strongly considered like a Zodiac Super Seawolf pre-owned.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
They go new great for like $13.95, I think. So, you know, you can get them a bit under $1,000 pre-owned sometimes. It's a handsome watch. It's one that's got some heritage. They're well-made, et cetera. So that would be a good second choice. And also the Diver 65, I found a couple of 42 millimeter Diver 65s from Oris pre-owned for $850. And the 42 wouldn't be my first choice. So it kind of fell down my list a little bit, but you know, I love Oris and I think Oris would fit in if you can find one in this category, but also in our next category. But
totally,
it was out because of like with the Aquas range, kind of going back to my criteria and versatility, it doesn't accept aftermarket straps very well, but the Diver 65 does. And for that reason, it was kind of on my short list for sub $1,000 category. So
yeah, I also went the Oris route and dug around a little bit. I've owned a few, so that there were a few that were knocked off, like the 65, the TT,
yeah,
that sort of thing. But they definitely are a contender at being a sneaky good value for some of their Salida-based stuff that happens to slip just barely into three digits.
Yeah.
That's a lot of watch. Yeah. Once it's depreciated, I mean they're good. I think they're a decent value when they're brand new.
Right.
So you're really going a long distance. The weird thing for me is I feel like I must have internalized how much this comes up on the Slack and in the Q&As. But the Seiko thing, I was, you know, the worry of getting a movement that couldn't manage being worn 31 days a month,
mm-hmm.
like without constantly kind of resetting the time.
Yeah.
It's almost like if I had five watches, the Seiko would be easier. Because I wouldn't wear it back to back all the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But like as an everyday one watch, I don't want to have to reset it very often, if at all.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
10 seconds a year is about right for my one watch.
Yeah.
And like you'd be lucky. And I have a story coming up where I time a bunch of my watches. So stay tuned to that. And shout out Jason Gallup for helping me with it. But the Seiko, my Seiko keeps decent time, but the way that its movement operates is wild. The amplitude is all over the map. The beat air is all over the map. You'll see this in the story. I got lucky with one that manages to average out pretty nicely over six positions.
Yeah.
And over how long is the power reserve? About 70 hours, I measured it.
Mm-hmm.
It just does it for me. I dig the marathon.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I like it.
Yeah. So, Saul, we've got a Willard and we've got a Marathon Steel Navigator. Not bad. I mean, both great one watch options and both good markers at their value for the price that we found. So,
yeah.
Solid stuff. Now, if we take the budget and we multiply it by five,
mm-hmm.
I actually found this to be harder.
Hmm.
Because the stuff I really like at this price point, I own.
Yeah.
I would buy the Pelagos or something very similar. And I'm very curious because I went with a little bit of a left field option here, a watch that I haven't even had on my wrist in 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, yeah.
But has always kind of been on my memory. But let's stick with the format. I'm curious to hear your thinking for $5,000 and then what you picked.
I love this category. I think this is probably my favorite category. I think I found the sub $1,000 difficult, just due to my kind of elimination of micro brands from consideration, as well as some of the other criteria I was talking about, but I think sub 5,000, it's a sweet spot for me. And I think, you know, I can even go, you know, almost squeak under sub 4 in some cases with some of the options.
It would almost have been easier at $3,000.
Yeah. Right. Right. And certainly at this price point, like if ask me a week ago and I would have stated the watch that's on my wrist right now today, this Pelagos FXD, I think at $4,100, $4,200 or whatever it is, it would just be a killer one watch. I mean, seriously, like this watch, it would be incredible as a one watch, but can't do it according to our self-imposed rules here. If I wanted to stay in the Tudor family, boy, I've been smitten with the Black Bay 54, but without going down that path.
Which is under five.
It is under five, yeah. And it's a handsome watch. I, you know, wore one a little bit while we were in Florida. Really cool, very versatile. Can dress up, dress down, take straps, etc. But let's not go into too much detail because my pick is a Zin U50.
Ah, great choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've often thought that Zin is one of those watches that would just, it's kind of the perfect one watch. And I think another criteria that I think about with kind of this one watch experiment is this idea that you can't opt for a beater if you're traveling to a sketchy place, et cetera. I mean, this is the one you have to wear. And I think Zins have a good way of, they fly under the radar, but they also are like a little kind of secret wink or handshake or nod to like fellow watch nerds. And I think I like that kind of mix. And I think, you know, these also, you know, I remember when these came out, you know, we were, you know, thrilled with it. And then of course, since then they've come out with the T50, which is a titanium version, but the styling of the T50 didn't quite do it for me, but the U50 just really speaks to me. It's such a cool watch. I had a U1 years ago. I love the styling. It was just a big, heavy watch. And this one at 41 millimeters and 11, little over 11 millimeters thick, it's kind of a sweet spot. And in terms of the specific version, I really like the SDR version that has the black bezel.
Yeah, of course.
That's the one you. That I would go for. And currently Watch Buys has that for sale for $3,340. I mean, I'm well under the $5,000, so I can buy, and that's on the bracelet. So, you know, I could pick up the Zin rubber for this if I wanted to, not aftermarket, but, you know, OEM strap. I can do scads of NATO straps, leather, et cetera, whatever I want to do with this. I just think a Zin at sub $5,000, one watch, it's perfect. I mean, it's absolutely perfect. So that's where I landed.
Yeah, I can't, I cannot refute that pick at all. I had a very short list for the $5,000 and the T50 was on it. I'm going to pivot as you picked a Zin. Let's keep it a little bit more interesting. We've already talked about how good the U50 and the T50 are, and that's deeply true. They're excellent watches. I'm down to two, and I can't decide.
I'll help you.
Well, here, how about if you can guess one of them, I'll go with that one.
No, I don't know. Would it be a Seamaster of some sort? Can you even get in a Seamaster?
No, I'm going a little bit wilder than that.
All right, okay.
And I'm going to make a decision, and then we'll talk about the other ones because there's a couple options here. But I'm going to go with a carbon Doxa.
Oh, okay.
Sub 300 carbon.
Wow. All right.
The game time decision where I'm going to go a little bit wild is I want the Shark Hunter.
Yeah.
Not the White Pearl.
Yep.
As a one watch, I think the White Pearl is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think there's something so quiet and cool and black and orange about the Shark Hunter.
Yeah.
This is in my top three watches that I love that I have not yet owned. So easy choice to fall into this. I would not even size the rubber. It would come off immediately. and I would put it on a NATO and just wear it all the time. Yeah. And I think this is one of those, a great watch at the $5,000 price point because it has a classic footprint, if you will, aesthetic profile, that sort of thing. But of course, very modern with the carbon, very specific with the Doxa and the orange. There's something I just absolutely love about that orange minute hand and the orange on the dial and the orange on the bezel.
Yeah.
And as much as I adore the White Pearl, I think the White Pearl's great if you have 10 other watches or three other watches or whatever. But for me, even over the Pro or the Caribbean or any of the other options, it's going to be the Shark Hunter. So yeah, Doxa sub 300 carbon, which is $3,890. So I got a grand for NATOs.
Yeah, we both could have gone sub 4,000. I mean, it's crazy. I think that's an excellent choice. I had considered Doxa. I just thought in terms of 24/7, 365, one watch, versatility wasn't quite up there with the Doxa. And I would question going all black and carbon.
Sure.
But, you know, the odds of breaking the carbon or, you know, you mentioned that you're not doing a lot of black tie stuff anymore. I mean, even with black tie, hey, you could pull that off. It'd be kind of stealthy under a cuff, but,
black tie, just take it off and put it in your pocket at that point.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
But it's funny because the where my mind went immediately was the Tudors I've not owned. So, you know, 58 navies, $4,500, probably the best, like all things concerned, that's probably the one watch to go with.
Mm-hmm.
I just find the Doxa to be like significantly more interesting as a one watch.
Right. Yeah.
Black Bay Pro is like undeniably good value and an interesting watch at about $4,200 used, $4,750 mm-hmm. brand new on the strap. If you want the bracelet in under $5,000, you got to go used. I had a standard blue Pelagos used for $4,400.
Oh, wow.
Like pre-owned and ready to go with the bracelet. That's just a great watch. I've worn it several times, reviewed it before, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the one that I was really hemming and hawing, the coin flip for the Carbon Doxa was a Heritage Chrono Blue.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Okay, that's really out of left field. I did not know that about you. Not being a chronograph guy, and yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I absolutely love that watch. I kind of always have. It's got a 12-hour bezel, so it could do the travel. It's got 150 meters of water resistance, so I'm not taking it off to go in the pool or on a dive.
Yeah, yeah.
The chronograph, I'm like hit or miss on, but it's such a beautiful watch, the mm-hmm. blue one specifically for me.
Yeah.
I find it to be so beautiful. I've just liked it for a long time. It's a little bit big, but if I only had the one watch, mm-hmm. I think I would get used to it and then not think about it again.
Yeah.
Who cares how big the watch is when you just have the one?
Right. Right.
I know that it's not too big for my wrist, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
if I'm not playing comparison against something that's like ideal,
yeah.
then, you know, you've got what you've got. But yeah, it's the, those are the two that it came down to. The Heritage Chrono Blue, which you can get for about $4,000 all day long. I think it's okay value for that money. I mean, Tudor's chronographs have come a step further with the Breitling movement.
Mm-hmm.
That you can get in some of them, but of course they don't offer that movement in the Chrono Blue, or they don't still make the Heritage Chronos.
Yeah.
But you can find them for about $4,000. They also, of course, made the black version if that's what you prefer. And then I just went with the Carbon Doxa because I thought like there's something about it. I love this watch.
Yeah, yeah. That's the right call. I think for a number of reasons, I think it was a good call for you. I think. It's interesting when you look at a one watch selection, you can go one of two ways. You know, you can either go safe and sort of down the middle, very versatile, very in terms of styling, you know, not something too outlandish, or you can go like, if this is the one watch I'm going to wear, I want it to be interesting and keep me captivated for a good long time. And I think, you know, the sub-$1,000, we both opted for fairly conventional watches. I think in this category, a Zin is something, the U50 is something that would keep me entertained for a very long time while also being versatile. I think the Carbon Doxa or the Chrono Blue might lean in the other direction. A little bit less versatile, a little bit more funky, both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, which I think the double black with the Shark Hunter helps a little bit.
Yeah.
But I agree that the in terms of like money well spent, money spent on quality and refinement and that sort of thing, your money goes further with Zin than it does with a Carbon Doxa, I think.
Yeah.
But that doesn't deny the fact that I find the Carbon Doxa to be like more appealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
They're just a lot of fun. And then talking about fun, we're at the 10X option. We're at $10,000 for our final pick, one watch for $10,000. I had trouble with this.
Yeah, I did too.
I really had to kind of search around. It's not an amount of money I've spent on a watch before. It's not really an amount of money I want to spend on a watch. Like, I don't think... I've got a pick. Hopefully it's not the same one as you. Otherwise, I'm a little bit screwed. I've got a pick, but deep down, I would almost prefer most of what I picked or had shortlisted for $5,000over the $10,000 option. You're getting a different sort of watch at $10,000, but you're paying the extra $5,000 is almost exclusively for the brand.
Right, right. True.
So I'm curious, with $10,000 for one watch that you plan to wear indefinitely,
what'd you
settle on?
All right. Well, I had two, one pre-owned, one new that is right at $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
The one I'm going to go with is possibly against some better judgment, but it's a watch I have loved for a long time. And that is a pre-owned Rolex Sea-Dweller 4000 16600. I have found a couple sub 10,000. There's one on Bob's Watches. I found a couple on Chrono 24 that come in right around 9,000. I think I've seen a couple for less. But, you know, I had one of these watches on loan several years ago, and I kind of feel like it's the last of what I would term kind of the great Sea Dwellers, kind of in the formula of the early ones. You know, certainly a vintage, you know, 1665 would be a blast. It's kind of my favorite of the Sea Dweller history. But in terms of a modern one, that Sea Dweller 4000, really ticked a lot of boxes. It's a cool watch. And I think, you know, as someone who owns a Submariner, that I don't wear very much, you know, Rolex comes up so often as a one watch option. The one hesitation I have about a Rolex as a one watch is the part of the criteria that I mentioned earlier. And that is like, you got to wear this wherever you go. And a Rolex, you know, sadly has become a bit of a magnet, or a bit of a target rather, for theft. So that would give me pause. But, you know, without the Cyclops, put it on a NATO, you know, just be kind of aware of your surroundings and prudent with where you wear it. I think, you know, how can you beat it as a one watch, right?
Oh no. So I got nothing. I don't have a backup.
I have, all right.
For 10 grand. But I had it. Yeah. I had a 16660 or 16600, whatever you get your hands on.
Yeah.
And if you can find yours, the one that you listed, I believe is the last one with an aluminum bezel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's the one to go with.
Yep. Yep. I've got the backup choice that one of us we'll share these watches. The No Time to Die Seamaster 300 in titanium on the mesh is $10,000 exactly on Omega's website. So 42 millimeter titanium case. It's a watch that I've gone back and forth on. You know, really liked it when it came out. Then I was like, they lean a little too hard into certain areas. I don't really like it. But I keep coming back. I keep looking at it. It's a great watch. And I think, you know, hesitation in real world consideration is, it's $10,000. I mean, I would never pay that for this, you know. I like my 2254 too much. But if we're talking, we've got the budget and it's going to be one watch, you'd be hard pressed to find something kind of more higher quality and a better watch to kind of wear 24/7.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I mean, I guess if we absolutely have to find an alternative of some sort, I think I could get my way into the smaller Bathyscaphe.
I saw for a few of those.
Under 10 grand.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be perfectly happy with one of those. Not wild with the date display, but kind of love everything else about those watches.
Yeah, yeah.
The truth is, if I was spending this kind of money on a watch, which I don't really aspire to at this point, there's something about a Seadweller that I've just loved since I first laid eyes on them.
I know.
And I turned one down years and years and years ago, 2008, 2009, for just a few grand.
Yeah.
Right? Like they weren't always what they, and even now they're not, they don't, their pricing doesn't really keep up with a sub because they're a little bit thicker, a little heavier, a little bit more esoteric. I think that they're hugely cool watches. If you're going to spend something like 10 grand, I really can't fault you on going with the Seadweller. The name alone gets me.
Yeah.
Seadweller.
Yeah, right, right.
It's so good.
Yeah.
And those last ones with the aluminum bezel, just absolute peaches. And yeah, the older, I would go with almost, the weird thing is, because we talked about with the $1,000, the idea of getting something new is really nice.
Right.
But at 10 grand, I would almost go find the oldest Seadweller you can get that's in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can get older than a 16600, then all the better.
Yeah.
You're not going to use that water resistance anyways.
Right.
It's just a very cool dive watch with an incredible backstory. All right. Well, there you go. We've got our three picks for three different timelines in one watch ownership. Jason, why don't you give folks a little summary of your three?
All right. Well, at the sub-$1,000 category, my one watch would be the Seiko SPB 237, the so-called Willard. It was a limited edition. And I found a pre-owned example for $850 on Reddit. So at the sub $5,000 level, I went with a Zin U50, specifically the SDR version, fully tegamented on bracelet, which you can get from Watch Buys new for $3,340, so well below our $5,000 limit. And at sub $10,000, I'm going with a pre-owned Rolex Seadweller. 16600. This is the Seadweller 4000 from a few years back, with an aluminum bezel. Great watch. And currently I found one pre-owned on Bob's Watches for $9,595. So a hair under our budget. And I still think it's a killer deal for one of the coolest watches around. How about you? What are your picks?
For my $1,000 pick, I went with a Marathon Navigator in steel. You can actually get it for well under $1,000. Also well under the price range is the $3,990-ish. I think it might actually be more like $3,890 for the Shark Hunter, but I want the Doxa Sub 300 Carbon. You know, maybe if you caught me in a different mood, I'd pick a different color, but I think it would be the Shark Hunter with the black dial and the orange minute hand. And then finally at $10,000, I was also going for a 16600, and I didn't really have any alternatives. There are several other great watches. We listed a handful of them a few minutes ago, so you can sub one of those in, or maybe this is just a world where somewhere down the line, Jason and I each just daily older sea dwellers and and are happy because of it.
Yeah.
So a fun little challenge. This is one that I would love to extend to everybody listening. If you're part of the Slack, so if you're a supporter of the show, by all means, hit up the episode chat channel, and we can start a thread as to what people would pick for these three price points. And if you're not part of the Slack and not interested, by all means, you can leave your comment on the Substack post for this episode, episode 256. And I really look forward to seeing what three folks kind of put together as what they would want for these kind of, like we said, three different timelines in watch ownership, whether you have $1,000, $5,000, or $10,000 to spend on just one watch. So that was a super fun one, Jason. Thank you for that. And good picks all around. I think you win because you actually got a $10,000 pick in. So congratulations on that as well.
Well, only by the merits of my going before you did. Otherwise, I would have been in the same boat. Yeah, fun episode. I think these one watch picks are popular. And I think to kind of tie them to a budget, it's a little more challenging and a little more kind of real world than... we've done a few others where we've done like a brand challenge where you pick three from one brand, which I think is a little less realistic. So this was particularly fun.
Totally. Well, hey, you want to get into some final notes then?
Yeah, sure. I had this item in my Amazon cart for a very long time, without pulling the trigger on it, so to speak, pardon the pun here, but it's a Theragun, a Theragun Prime specifically. And this is, if you're familiar with these tools at all, it's sort of what they call it, percussive massage. And it's an ergonomically shaped handheld massage device that has sort of an reciprocating massage head that you hold against your leg, your calf muscle, your forearm, your shoulder, whatever. And it delivers a pretty strong, almost a shiatsu style deep tissue massage. And mm-hmm. I'm someone who's I seem to be, especially as I'm getting older, have chronically sort of tight muscles, especially like my calves or my quadriceps after I go for a long bike ride or a hike or anything like that. And I just really like the idea of these, but they were always a little bit expensive to kind of make an impulse buy. But I finally decided to get one. It arrived a couple days ago, and I've been loving it. And using it on the lowest setting, it's plenty strong, and it really delivers what it promises. I mean, it's really a nice sort of deep tissue, sort of pounding, if you like that sort of thing. I like a good deep tissue massage. And this, you can do it yourself. You can have a partner or somebody else, do it. Let's say it's on a hard to reach area like your back. But yeah. Just a real fan. Definitely no buyer's remorse on this. I really like it. It's the Theragun Prime Quiet Deep Tissue Therapy Massage Gun. And this one has all these nice bells and whistles. There's like it's Bluetooth enabled, so you can operate it remotely. I don't know how you'd do that, and all these other features. Comes with a variety of massage heads that I have yet to try. But just in its most basic form, it's a really cool device. So yeah, check it out. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, they're super handy. I have I've owned like a knockoff version.
Yeah,
I can go back through my Amazon and find it. But if you literally just Google or Amazon search massage gun, mm-hmm. There's like several of them for $50.
Oh yeah,
I think at the time I paid more than $50. I paid about $100, but there was no Prime when I bought mine.
Yeah, yeah.
There was just the Theragun Pro, which is about $500.
Yeah.
And I figured I would try this, see how we liked it. And I don't use it nearly as much as I should. But anytime where, yeah, I have that weird tightness, it's a lot of times like I get back from a trip mm-hmm. and I've just been sitting on a plane for a long time.
Yeah,
something in my body will be upset. And I highly recommend them. The Theragun product is worth the money. My brother's a huge fan. I have a cousin who works in physiotherapy and swears by them. I went with a cheaper one just to try it out and have not been let down by it in any way. We just keep using it. They've been very nice and simple to use and all that kind of thing. So highly recommend. Good suggestion.
Just as a budget aside, even more budget than yours. If you have a Black & Decker jigsaw, electric jigsaw, you can actually buy massage head attachments that will work on those. Albeit it's a lot louder and a lot less.
Man, could you imagine how loud that would be?
Well, I know exactly how loud it is because I went for a massage that was not that great a couple of months ago, and the massage therapist asked if I wanted to give it a try, and she plugged it in and went to work on my back, and it worked, but man, was it loud. I mean, I felt like I was in, you know, woodshop class back in high school or something. But yeah.
I would have so many intrusive thoughts about somebody cutting into me with a jigsaw blade rather than some kind of squishy ball. Yeah, right, but right. That's fun. Yeah. They're really handy things to have, especially if you find the calf thing feels like constant.
Yeah.
I don't think my calves have been loose in 20 years.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're definitely good for that. Can feel great and definitely make a difference. If you really want the twofer, get yourself a heating pad that you can lay down so you can actually like sit and do a little bit of work with your calves, get them nice and warm, and then hit them with the gun.
Good call. Yeah,
it's pretty good. And like those heating pads, again, all day long on Amazon for not that much money. We get a lot of use out of the one that we've got. It gets warm really quick and is great for lower back and calf stuff.
All right, what do you have?
Yeah, so mine this week, as I kind of hinted at the top of the show, is a brand new nylon watch strap that I really like. It's from Watches of Espionage, so it's part of their store. It's part of how you can support the website. We've obviously talked a ton about WOE and what they're up to and some great stories. We've linked to it in the past. Then they've done an array of sort of merchandise, watch roll, like sleeves to store watches for travel and you know, challenge coins and that sort of thing. But these NATOs are $35 and they're awesome. Watches of Espionage gave me a sort of envelope with a few different options. So I've got, I think, three different ones here. And I put the tan one on the Skirfa, and it's thin. It feels great. It's not shiny. It's not slippery. The hardware is awesome. Very similar in kind of quality and execution to the TGN NATOs, but these are available. And at $35, like, we saw the NATOs for a lot more than that because it comes with full-on, you know, kind of show support and some other benefits. But I think at $35, it's a little bit on the high side for just a NATO. But knowing that you get to support Watches of Espionage makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm super impressed with it. I even enjoy the options they've done with a stripe, which really isn't generally my vibe. But they do sort of a greenish tan with a stripe that I think is actually quite handsome.
Yeah. Yeah, they're great straps, and I also got a little sort of gift pack from him as well, and have enjoyed them. My only quibble now is that I've got this watch that refuses to leave my wrist, and the Pelagos that takes 22mm straps. So I might have to place an order with him for a couple of 22s, because yeah, they are really good stuff.
Yeah, and I think because of the red text on the Pelagos, the 22 with the olive and the red stripe could be pretty good.
Yeah, definitely.
I've been wearing a ton of the Coyote Brown, which is like that nice, warm, sandy sort of color, the Coyote, similar to what you see in lots of other brands when they use that term. Yeah. And it's just really good.
Yeah.
Simple, straightforward, nice hardware. Like I said, just nice stuff for $35. Support you know, another great kind of operator in the space, and check out that stuff. So that'll be in the show notes, of course. But it is called the 5i Nylon Watch Strap. And I'm always on the lookout for another great NATO, and this one immediately kind of leapt to the top of you know, sort of my options as it does something that's very similar to the gray NATOs that we offer. Nicely made, just wears really well.
All right, well, fun episode. I hope everybody enjoyed that. Finally, we're doing one that doesn't involve travel and diving, but back to kind of our core of watches. So good stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes and get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from William Feather, who said, "A budget tells us what we can't afford, but it doesn't keep us from buying it."